So I sued the Times for libel. Of course, that was lèse majesté as far as that was concerned. And as circumstance would have it, a young lawyer from Washington came to Anchorage representing a firm that was peddling an atomic reactor that they wanted Chugach to build. And so he was trying to ingratiate himself with the powers that be. And he told me that A. Robert Smith, the special correspondent, was his roommate in Washington and had confided in him that the story had been planted by Atwood personally. There was no Interior Department source that had given him this. And I guess he wanted to, you know, make me happy, and he told me that. And I had a friend in Washington depose Smith, and he confessed that the high-ranking, reliable Interior Department source was really Bob Atwood. And then Atwood was deposed, acted like a fool in the deposition, and finally admitted that it was rumor and gossip he had picked up in one of the local eateries where there was a place called the Oyster Loaf at the corner of 4th and F, where Woolworth is now. And everybody ate there. The food was terrible, but it was a place, you know, sort of like Central Intelligence. You went there and exchanged it. And that's where he picked it up. And that's how it got planted. And then one thing led to another, and sued the Times a couple times for libel, and then people who had a beef against the Times came to me, and I filed libel suits for them. And I got a reputation of being the nemesis of the Times. And of course, at that time, for a long time, I was attorney for the Daily News, and then still their fair-haired boy until we finally split over the Hickel-Hammond contest. And, you know, the feud went on so long that both forgot what started it. But after 78, we sort of formed the detente. I've always had good working relationship with the working, well, good relations, personal relationship with the working press of both papers. The editorial people were more in tune with me at the News than they were at the Times, but Bill Tobin and I had always sort of mutually respected each other without necessarily liking each other. And I finally got to the point where Atwood and I sort of made an uneasy peace. In between, he had written at least two very vicious editorials against me, one of which was answered by the Kodiak Mirror, whose editor then was Carl Armstrong, who was a former news reporter, daily news reporter, and a friend of mine, and a staff member of the governor's office in the Hickel days. He replied with an editorial called An Act of Malice. And Dave Thorsen, who had been the Times attorney in my first libel suit, accused me of setting him up again, you know. Okay.
Did that publicity hurt you professionally?
Not at all. In fact, one of the reasons I had to settle with the Times for a pittance the first time is because they finally succeeded in getting my income tax returns, and they showed that every time they libeled me, my income went up. No, it never hurt me. It might have hurt me politically if I wanted to run for office.
Did you?
I did in 68. After I quit as Attorney General, I ran for the State Senate in the Democratic primary, and I was nominated along with Joe Josephson. There were two seats at stake. And I had an interesting experience. In the middle of the primary, the Daily News called me. There'd been a bunch of kids that had come off the firefighting jobs with the BLM. And the government had done its usual screw up, and the paychecks didn't arrive in time. So they were stranded in Anchorage. And it was in the summer, and they camped on the railroad right away down by Bootlegger's Cove, close to people like Atwood and others, the silk stocking folk, and So there was a big complaint, and they were arrested. And one of them was a kid that sort of was an early hippie. The others were all perfectly normal middle-class kids, but they found a little grass, and they found some birth control pills in the girl's tent, and oh, God, this was terrible. And they were languishing in jail on a trespass charge, and the Daily News asked me to help them. And I got them out of jail instantly, got the charges dismissed, got my picture in the news, surrounded by my grateful clients, and then I had a big backlash from my electorate. One guy said, "You just lost the Barber vote." I didn't know I had it. And one woman who had a beauty barber supply had my picture in her window, and she took it out, and she says, "I've been trying to get my daughter to keep her hair neat." And all because one kid was there with long hair. So I said to myself, wait a minute, what am I doing here? I mean, am I going to be, anytime I do something that I think is right, I'm going to be responsible, accountable to a bunch of yahoos that I don't even know? Plus, I had spent quite a bit of money in the primary to be nominated, and I was going to, I had a poll done by a national pollster, which showed a certain polarization, and that I would, and an estimate that I would have to spend even more in the general, although they thought I had a good chance of being elected. And then I suddenly realized that that meant I had to go back to Juneau, which I hated. And so I came to the conclusion, to hell with it. And I just remarried, and my wife and my adopted children were living up here, and I didn't want to go to Juneau. And so I withdrew with the only proviso that I would have the right to veto any nomination by the Democratic Central Committee. And we finally agreed on John Rader. John Rader had lost the nomination. He had run for Congress on an anti-Vietnam platform, and he lost. Alaska was fairly hawkish in those days. And he was looking for a slot, and I like Johnny, I always have. And I said, fine. And that's when he got elected to the Senate and stayed until he became president of the Senate and retired. That was my only venture into politics other than my appointed job as Attorney General.
Mm-hmm. You were going to tell me about Gordon Hartman.
Yeah, when I was sitting in my little office in the semi-basement of the federal building, and a fellow in olive drabs and shoe packs slugged into my office. Young lawyer, just come in from Ohio. And apparently he had a reference to Dan Cuddy, and Dan Cuddy had referred him to me. He was looking for a job. And at that time, I knew that McCary was looking for somebody to make to appoint as U.S. commissioner. So I sent Gordon to him, and he got the job. Then later on, Gordon's path and mine crossed again. We had a fellow named, I'm trying to think of his first name, I think it was John. His name, last name was Swan. Swan had the labor unions sewed up. He represented all of them, and it was a lucrative practice. Jim Swan. And when I first started practicing with Vern Martin, a fellow named Marion Davis came into my office. He was the president of the Painters Local. And a guy named Harrison was the business agent. And Harrison had been the treasurer. And the Painters had been victimized by the former treasurer, who went south with a lot of money. And when Harrison became the treasurer, there was an investigation by Buckaloo's office into allegations of more embezzlement and fraud. And the FBI investigated it. And Marion Davis, who was a very upright type, instead of resisting their fishing expedition, said, "Hey, want the Union's books? Here they are." Well, Bucklow and the FBI, shooting from the hip as usual, went and arrested Harrison. Only trouble was they didn't have enough evidence and had to let him go. But Harrison was furious when he was released because he felt that Marion Davis had exposed him to this. He should have resisted the seizure of the Union's books and gotten a lawyer to fight it. Davis had not tried to get Harrison into trouble, but Harrison would not listen at all. So he brought charges, and Davis was discharged by the Union from the presidency and fined and suspended from membership. And he came to me to, he knew that I had some labor law experience, and he came to me to represent him in his appeal to the International Union. But he also told me, you know, that's only part of my problem. I've got a damn good job out at the base as a painter. He was an excellent painter. In fact, I've been offered the foreman's job, but turned it down because I'm such a strong union person. I didn't want to be part of management. But now Harrison has sworn that he's going to get me fired, and I can't afford that. I have a family to support. I said, well, you just go back to work, and if anything happens, immediately you come down to see me. A few days later, he was down. No. First, I said, let me talk to the union. And I had always, you know, I had such close ties to organized labor in my career that I felt I could talk that language. And to this day, I feel that way. Still, you know, represent Jess Carr personally, and I've represented the Teamsters and other unions. And so I went to see Harrison, and I went to see the president of the local, whose name escapes me, the new president, but he was very prominent. And I said, look, you guys, I don't want to fight you. I said, we're going the appeal route in the union for the discipline that you have inflicted on Davis, but for God's sakes, don't take his livelihood away, you know. And Harrison looked at me, and through his clenched teeth, he said, oh, get that son of a bitch, it's the last thing I do. So then I went to Jim Swan, and I said, Jim, it goes against my grain to do this to a union, but if they fire this man, or get this man fired from his job, it's an unfair labor practice, and I'll go to the NLRB. And he laughed, because those were the days when a union couldn't do wrong in the NLRB. A couple of days later, Marion Davis came down and said Harrison had gone out to the superintendent and said, look, if you don't fire Davis, I'll pull this job. In other words, I'll pull the union painters off. And he says, gosh, you know, I can't afford that. And he was working for an outside company, and it would have been his job. So he let him go, even though he had just a few weeks before offered him the foreman's job because he was so good and such a hard worker. So I had a young man working for me. I just started him in business as an investigator. My name was Chris Katsikouris. He later on became a Teamster bigwig in Fairbanks during the pipeline days. I had formed his company called the Bonded Bureau of Investigations, and Chris had himself a silver badge made. I sent him out to talk to the superintendent, and he went out and flashed his badge, and the guy apparently was afraid he's going to get busted for non-support of a child somewhere. And when he found out that Chris came to see him about Marion Davis, he was so relieved he spilled his guts and wrote a long statement about how Davis was his best worker and how he had done it under duress because he couldn't afford to get the job shut down at this time of the year and blah, blah, blah. And we put that in our file and filed a NLRB complaint, which was duly investigated and tried. And the NLRB found both the union and the employer guilty of an unfair labor practice. They ordered back pay for Davis. They ordered a retraction posted in a conspicuous place, and the whole bit. I mean, they really ground their noses in the dust. And the painters' union leadership hated me from then on. And Jim Swan was disbarred subsequently, because he was a terrible alcoholic, and he got to be so bad that he would take filing fees in divorce cases, drink them up, and then tell the people they were divorced. I mean, he was a menace to himself and everybody else. And Walt Hodge and I were instrumental in helping disbar him, because for his own protection, because sooner or later he'd wound up in jail. We didn't like to do it, because we both liked him.
What happened to him?
He went and worked as a carpenter on the North Slope or something. Mm-hmm. So.
Were there a lot of alcoholics in the bar? Was it a big problem?
I would say yes.
Why?
Well, it was a rather bleak environment in those early days. Nothing like today. No cultural amenities. No housing was relatively poor. There wasn't really much else to do. It's still true in a lot of the small towns here in Alaska. Anyway, getting back to how did Hartleep ties into this? So at this point, the unions were looking for somebody to take over where Schwann had left off, and I was approached by the carpenters and a couple others, knowing that I had a background in labor law. The only other person who had the background in labor law, although not nearly as much and wasn't nearly as well known, was Gordon Hartley. And I had, you know, gotten involved with Shugach Electric, which was an employer, and other employer clients. And I have never felt, although some people disagree, I've never felt that you can represent employers and unions at the same time. There's an economic conflict of interest that arises. And so I said the only way I would take them is if I got them all. And they came back to me and said, we can't deliver the painters. They won't go with you. So I declined, and then Hartleep got the job, so to speak, which brought him in turn into a position to get on the board of directors of First Federal Savings and Loan, because it was founded mainly with labor money. Mm-hmm. And that was the turning point in his career, because he then eventually just became a banker and stopped practicing law. And Rader was their house counsel, having the firm of Hartleep, Groh, and Rader having split up. So that's how Hartleep ties in.
Has Rader ever practiced?
Oh, yeah. He practiced when he was with McCutcheon and Nesbitt, and he practiced with Hartleep, Groh, and Rader. They used to refer to them as Heartless, Grab, and Rodent.
Why?
Well, they were very aggressive. And,
how were they aggressive?
Well, you know, forceful, a little predatory, and a young, hungry law firm trying to get ahead. Three pretty talented people, and not necessarily too squeamish to play hardball. Mm-hmm. And they stepped on a lot of toes. Okay, Ed Arnell, we've talked about. Roger Creamer, we've talked about. Roger, of course, was a gentleman's gentleman. He's a man of very high principle, probably one of the finest legal minds in Alaska. I tried to get him appointed to the Supreme Court, and he declined twice. Roger is very limelight shy. He's a very private person. For years he practiced law with First National Bank as his major client, and Hickel as his client, and John Stepp as his client. He had a very small but very lucrative practice, and he wouldn't put his name on the door of his office. That's how private here.
Why
is he? I don't know. I'm not a psychiatrist, but that's the way he is. He and Groh are very close friends. They come from the same neck of the woods in upstate New York. And at one time we had a plan to, which I talked Roger into. We were going to form a super firm, McCutcheon, Cremo, Boyko, and Groh. And everybody went, and Wendell Kay, and everybody went for that idea except Cliff Groh, because he was the protege of Elmer Rasmus in the First National Bank, and at that time Elmer hated McCutcheon. He wouldn't let Cliff go for it, and when Cliff wouldn't go, Roger wouldn't go, and the whole thing fell apart. And ironically, later McCutcheon and Groh got together and got rich off of the Native claim.
Why? How did Groh become protege of Elmer Rasmus?
The National Bank of Alaska always, as I call it, chippied around. They didn't have a certain lawyer like First National, always had Roger Cremo. But increasingly they made use of Groh, and Elmer started taking Cliff into real estate ventures like the Huntington Park subdivision, and Cliff got pretty wealthy off of that. And so he wasn't in a position to cross Elmer, and Elmer was very autocratic. I mean, if you belong to Elmer, you belong to him all the way. And because he's Atwood's brother-in-law, and he and I never got along. In fact, my first contact with Wally Hickel, my first association with Wally Hickel, came and he approached me to see what I could do to get Elmer Rasmus's dogs off his heels, because Elmer was trying to destroy Hickel. And I was, by this time, known as the kind of guy that if a bunch of hoodlums with crowbars were working you over in a dark alley, you called for Boyko to throw a hand grenade. And so that's how I met Hickel, was in a rebound from a confrontation with Rasmussen.
Did Hickel ever have any problems with the Cuttings?
No, they were always friendly, whether they had some, yes.
Okay.
Party politics was never a decisive factor in Alaska. Party politics was always secondary to personality and economic conflicts and confrontations. And party was really a secondary thing. Do with my glasses. Okay, thanks.
Thinking of putting the secret firm together, it made no difference that half of you were...
Well, of course, even outside, it never makes a difference. In fact, that's a sophisticated way to do it. You have a bipartisan firm in New York. It's also, they also balance it as to ethnics. They'll have a Jewish partner and an Italian partner, and an Irish partner, and a Republican, and a Democrat, and a liberal. That's the ideal way to do it. Personally, it never even occurred to me, you know, to think in terms of politics. My partners, half the time I didn't know their politics. I know Talbot and Tulin probably were Democrats. Walton is an independent. I'll be darned if I know what Gleddy, Pennington, Offer, Irwin were.
How do you pick your partners?
Usually because, well, it varied. Vern Martin approached me first, and he's a Republican, incidentally. Vern Martin approached me first, and I hardly knew anybody. Dave Talbot and I. Dave Talbot and I had worked together when he was U.S. Assistant U.S. Attorney, and I was the regional counsel for BLM, and we'd become friends, and we liked each other. I admired his fine legal training. He was a Cornell graduate and a good mind. And he had been working with Ralph Moody and wasn't very happy. First he went with K. Moody and Robison, and when the firm split up, he went with Ralph Moody. And was very unhappy.
Why?
Oh, they're just totally incompatible. And he was sort of an employee there, and Ralph didn't treat him too well. And then he came to me, but I was very disappointed because Dave was brilliant and creative and fine gentleman, but has no concept of the economic side of the practice and of the law. And he was, in addition to that, you know, I was overloaded with cases, and I gave him a bunch of cases to try, and he got them all tagged with different color tags and this and that. And then when it came to trial, he'd hand them back to me one by one because he couldn't try this one and he didn't want to try that one. And eventually I was as bad off as I had been before. So it was no real help to me, but we still stayed friends through all the years. Tulin was kind of a mariage de convenance because when I left, I knew I couldn't leave Dave Talbot alone. And Tulin was looking for a place to land, and he had a little money, and he and Dave Talbot bought me out, even though I had to co-sign the note with the bank for them to do it. And then it was my old office, and when I came back, it was a logical place to go back to. Kay Ritchie had worked for me in the Attorney General's office. And again, she's a fine lawyer who has no concept of how to make money. And almost broke me when I was gone for a month or been ill.
When you say no concept of making money, what does that mean?
Well, like for instance, she ran the office for a month without me because I was away and then I got sick. And she took in something like $30 in that month. She could never ask for a fee. She didn't know how. I was that way when I first started out. You know, I had a lady that once told me after I worked for her for a month and had never been paid. She was a foreign immigrant from Lithuania, and she says, "You charity lawyer, no?" And I said, "No." But it opened my eyes.
Uh-huh. How did you finally learn how to bill?
Survival. Mm-hmm. You either do that or you get out of the business. You have to.
Did
anybody
give you any pointers? Were other members of the bar helpful?
Oh, yeah. This was before I ever came to Alaska. By that time, I already knew how. Mm-hmm. Not as well as I do now. Now, I have a reputation for being very expensive, and I encourage it. It keeps the shoe clerks out and the freeloaders. There's lots of those. And it has nothing to do with their economic status. Some of the richest people are the most miserable when it comes to paying the lawyer. Mm-hmm. A perfectly good example was a guy named Merle Smith, also known as Mudhole Smitty, who was the president of Cordova Airlines. And when I first started out, which later merged with Alaska Airlines, when I first started out practicing, he came to me and he took me to lunch and he picked my brains. And he'd always been with McCary and Wilson and Wilson. But as I learned later, he had a habit, every time a promising young lawyer came into town, he'd romance him and wine him and dine him and pick his brain and get a lot of free work. And when they started billing him in earnest, well, then he'd drop him and go back to McCary and Wilson and Wilson. Mm-hmm. And he did that to me. And Jack Stern was working for him as a bookkeeper then, and Jack Stern called me one time because one of Smitty's Cordova Airlines pilots had gotten in trouble with immigration, and I straightened it out. And Smitty was out of town, and he almost fired Jack because he usually handled those things himself, and he didn't want to pay a lawyer fee. So pretty soon, you know, he left me high and dry and went back to McCary. And a couple of years later, a guy named Louis Oddsather from the firm of Oddsather Simpson, which later became Insurance Incorporated, came to me and he told me that Cordova Airlines had lost a plane over the Kenai Peninsula and they were insured with Insurance Inc., Hull Insurance, and they made a claim, and the insurance company had turned it down because it was discovered that that plane carried dynamite in violation of FAA rules. And the policy said that there was no coverage if it was a flight illegal to FAA rules, so they wouldn't pay. So Cordova Airlines hired Buell Nesbitt to sue the insurance company, which was understandable because there was a viable difference of opinion. There are two concepts. One is an exception, the other one is an exclusion. If it was an exception, it meant that if the illegal carriage of dynamite caused the crash, then they wouldn't be covered. Now, the illegal carriage of dynamite didn't cause the crash. But if it was an exclusion, that means the moment they start on the illegal voyage, they're not covered. Mm-hmm. Then they don't pay. So there was a legitimate legal issue. It's a funny business about that, too. But anyway, he sued them, but he also sued Insurance Inc., Odsather Simpson, on the theory that if he wasn't covered, they had negligently issued the policy. And Odsather, who is a very diffident sort of a guy, very, very reticent to say anything bad about anybody, and very personally liked, he was very upset, and he says, we've been carrying this son of a gun for years on his insurance premiums, and right now he owes us $14,000 on his workman's comp coverage, and that was a lot of money in 54, 55. Mm-hmm. And he says, no, it must have been 50, 55, 56. And he says, and he hired this SOB Nesbitt, and we thought we needed a bigger, a tougher lawyer to fight Nesbitt. So I believe with Melvin Laird that a good political maxim when people do you wrong is to forgive and remember. And I remembered that Smitty had horsed me around and taken advantage of me, and so it was a bit of a labor of love. In those days, you could go in on any contract claim and just file an attachment without any pre-attachment hearing and all the modern jazz that we now have. And so I grabbed his bank account and I hit his payroll. And this was, I guess, Odsather came in on Monday. I hit Monday morning. I hit the payroll account on Monday afternoon. Tuesday morning, Smitty came in all upset, saying, I can't, you've got to release that account. And I said, give me a certified check for $14,000 and you can have it. So he brought it in that afternoon. Wednesday morning, Odsather came in with some new files. They wanted to give me additional business. And I didn't say a word to him. I just sat there and listened and took notes on the other cases. And, you know, Odsather being the nice gentleman that he is, he sort of hemmed and hawed. And as he went out the door, he sort of turned and says, did you have a chance to start anything yet on that claim against Cordova Airlines? So I said, oh, yeah, I'm glad you reminded me. Here's the check. And he said, well, you're a magician. That was kind of fun.
Did you ever have to worry about, it was a very small community in the 50s, worrying about alienating people, worrying about...
I never have, and I'm sure I paid a price. Like, I've known halfway through my career that even if I desired judicial office, I probably would never get it. Mm-hmm. Because the only way you ever become a judge, and there are notable exceptions, but the only way you become a judge is by not being threatening to anybody, mm-hmm. and being all things to all people, and generally be not considered too brilliant, because brilliance always threatens the competition. If you beat people consistently in court, if you beat them once, they'll forgive you. If you beat them five or six times, they get to hate you. Mm-hmm. And I've beaten a lot of people, a lot of lawyers around this town. I've beaten them badly. Mm-hmm. And I stepped on a lot of toes, and I made a lot of waves. And when my name went up with the Supreme Court back in, I guess it was in the early 60s. I was endorsed by the Daily News and the Bar. And there was a man on the Judicial Council, a Juno lawyer, whom I helped to get there politically. And he came back later and says, I couldn't vote for you as a judge. You're too controversial. And I said, number one, you have no obligation to tell me how you voted. Number two, just because I put you on the council didn't mean you had to vote for me. And number three, the reason you gave is stupid. If you had said I'm incompetent, if you had said I'm unethical, if you had said I lack integrity, any of those things, judicial temperament, but controversial, so what? Clarence Darrow was controversial. Mm-hmm.
Are there lawyers who have been controversial and have been voted that have made it to the bench that you can point to?
Well, certainly Buell Nesbitt was controversial. I don't know whether he was brilliant. He was pretty capable lawyer. I don't think he was brilliant. But that was kind of a surprise to everybody, and I think it was a matter of cronyism between him and Egan. And also it came at the tail end of a honeymoon between him and the Bar. Mm-hmm. I think if it had come a year before or 2 years later, he wouldn't have made it.
Why was there a honeymoon between them?
Because he was the leader of the fight against McCarran. He was very articulate in it. And he was president of the Bar Association. And he was a champion, and he was a very aggressive guy. And you know, so the Bar looked to him for leadership in that fight. Let's see. Nobody else.
What about lawyers who are controversial, aggressive, and brilliant who haven't made it to the bench and might have wanted to?
I don't know if Wendell Kay ever aspired to it. He wanted to be governor. But no way he'd ever be appointed.
Why? Because of his criminal defense? Or?
Controversial. And Wendell, in his heyday, was a lot more, in a way, more of a maverick than I. He didn't care who he associated with or what he did, and he drank and played around in public and just flew into the face of all convention, you know. And it cost him. I'm sure he had a lot of fun. And, you know, there's trade-offs for everything. But he wanted to be governor, and it hurt him. I can't think of any other judges that are brilliant. Per se, I guess Zero Rabinowitz is brilliant, but he never got to be controversial because he never practiced law. Warren Matthews is probably brilliant, but he practiced very quietly. Bob Boutchever was brilliant, but he had a very conventional insurance defense practice in a small, homogeneous community, Juneau, and he was always a paragon of the conventional, even though he was far more liberal in his, at least in humanitarian areas, than his background would indicate. I can't think of any other brilliant judges that I would consider brilliant in this thing.
What about people in your situation who didn't become judges because they're controversial and brilliant?
People in my situation usually recognize that they're not going to be judges, and they don't even go for it. And I really didn't, but I got pushed by some of my friends at a time when I perfectly well knew that even if I got through the Judicial Council, that the governor, Egan, wasn't going to appoint me. But I wanted to see what happened. I wanted to have fun. And one of the things I did, I've always objected to the way judges are selected in Alaska. You apply for the job like for a janitor's job. And then they require you to have a medical certificate of your physical fitness, right? And I said, first of all, I think judges should be sought out. They shouldn't have to apply. Their peers should select them like they do in the British system. And number two, why a certificate of physical fitness and not a certificate of mental fitness, which is a far more important? I mean, a judge could have emphysema, but still have a very fine mind. And so I went to Dr. Ray, what the heck was his name, the psychiatrist who died recently of cancer. Can't think of it, but his clinic, Langdon, Dr. Ray Langdon, who was a friend and an occasional client. He was also president of the Alaska Bar at the time they voted in favor of decriminalizing marijuana, which sort of was a feather in his cap. And I was the first attorney, I was the attorney general of the state of Alaska who pushed through the first state law reducing ever in any state, reducing possession of marijuana from a felony to a misdemeanor, which was considered revolutionary in 67, 68. I went to Ray Langdon and I said, if I put myself through the testing of your clinic, will you give me a certificate as to whether or not I'm mentally fit to become a judge? And he said, are you serious about it? I said, yeah. Sure. So he assigned me to an associate of his by name of Dr. Bloom. And Bloom was a little bit taken aback. He thought I was making a grandstand play. And he said, well, what if we find you not fit? What will you do? I said, I'll withdraw my name. He said, okay. So I went through the whole thing, the psychological testing, the Rorschachs, the multiphasic, the whole bit, and interviews, and came out with a clean bill of health. And I filed that with my application. Thunderous silence. I mean, it shocked the bejeebers out of everybody, particularly the Chief Justice and ex officio chairman of Judicial Council. I think he thought that was a terrible thing to do. Because think of it, if all judges were required to do that, we'd lose half of the sitting judges. And never has it ever been mentioned that it's like somebody in the family died of a loathsome disease. But I enjoyed it tremendously.
I wanted to ask you about outside lawyers coming up, lawyers from Seattle. And I'd start in the early years, in the 50s, when you were here. Yes. Were there people who always came up?
The name Stuart Oles, O-L-E-S, comes to mind. He practically had the construction business sewed up.
What kind of business?
I don't remember. He was one of the name partners.
And Seattle.
Yeah. And there were also a number of lawyers who came up and beat the state regularly on condemnation cases. And I finally put an end to that by bringing in an outside lawyer to represent the state in the defense of, in the representation of the state in condemnation cases, my former law partner, Richard Richards from Los Angeles. And he turned the track record totally around. He won victory after victory for the state, which is too bad because later on I was on the outside again. And we were supposed to try a big case against each other, but it never came off. I was looking forward to that. He was a brilliant lawyer, super brilliant lawyer. Twice unsuccessful Democratic nominee for the U.S. Senate from California. His timing was off. Len Schrader, to this day, comes up. He's a specialist in personal injury and particularly medical legal problems, medical malpractice. By the way, I do some insurance defense work now, but limited to legal malpractice. I represent lawyers who have been accused of legal malpractice here and in California. That's the only insurance and defense work that I do.
What other outside lawyers were up here?
In the early days?
Yeah.
I think that's about it.
Len Schrader, is he from the firm?
Leonard Schrader, yeah. It's Schrader, Goldmark, and Bender.
Schrader, S.
Leonard, S-C-H-R-O-T-E-R. He's an interesting man. He worked for the Israeli government for 2 years in setting up a code of justice in the occupied Arab area, because he's a great civil libertarian and they wanted a civil libertarian. You don't read that in the newspapers. He also went to the Soviet Union and wrote a book on the fate of the Soviet Jews, Russian Jews in the Soviet Union, which didn't earn him, again from a civil libertarian point of view, which didn't earn him any points with the communists. And he's probably the finest medical legal expert in the country, one of a handful.
What happened with the construction business?
Well, they kind of started putting the brakes on it, and a lot of it went to Arnell and later to Burr, and some of it went to other firms. But of course now the Seattle firms are setting up branch offices here in violation of the bar rules, which say that you can't have a name partner who is not a member of the Alaska Bar, but they all do it. I once toyed with the gag idea of associating with Melvin Belli and F. Lee Bailey and setting up a firm of Bailey, Belli, and Broyko. Not that Belli would ever take second place to anybody, but I thought alphabetically I might talk him into it. And of course we would all have been disbarred and deported immediately. But you know, the fancy-pants Seattle firms, they can get away with it. Because the bar is gutless, it only goes after the weak ones. The bar is like a pack of wolves. You can do anything if you're strong and powerful. But the moment you break a leg and they taste a little blood, then they fall on you and devour you. That's what happened to, well, it was attempted to be done to Pete Walton and a couple others.
Did it start as early as 55?
What?
The bar being aggressive.
No.
When, how did it?
After statehood. The first time I came back and fight with Nesbitt, and then there were the good guys, but the Anchorage Bar was much more active in those days, less of a, is it working?
Yeah.
Less of a social club than it is now. But it was very informal and laid back and relaxed, and George Grigsby was the lifetime president, and Harold Butcher was forever the treasurer, and at every meeting we called for a treasurer's report, and he wouldn't have one. And we had a lot of fun. They were hard-drinking, fast-charging bunch, and nobody took anything of the bar business serious. Mm-hmm. The few exceptions were the time I tried to get the bar to back me with my fight with the municipality on the city attorney's job and a couple other things, like with Stringer and so on. But normally it was just a fun-loving group.
What was Stringer?
Well, you know.
Did you defend Stringer? Were you one of the defense?
Well, I didn't handle his case, but mm-hmm. I was on his side. I thought that he was being victimized. He had committed an indiscretion, but nothing that merited a full-fledged three-ring circus disbarment trial, for God's sake. Anyway, and in those days that was done in court. It was a U.S. attorney prosecuting. Mm-hmm. Trying to think who represented Stringer.
Kane.
Wendell
Butcher?
Kane? No, wasn't Butcher.
Wasn't Butcher.
No. Could have been Wendell Kane. I'm not sure. I know that Talbot was a witness and Fitzgerald was the prosecutor. Anyway, then after statehood, the first time I came back and met with the Anchorage Bar, of course the numbers had greatly increased. Instead of meeting in a East 4th Avenue spaghetti joint, they met at the Westwood Hotel, and Judge Davis was giving a pompous speech on court procedures, and everybody was Little Lord Fauntleroy, and it sort of turned my stomach.
Mr. Charlie Cole on my
phone. Yeah. Okay, we're back on tape.
Right.
Now, where were we?
We were in the construction business, Seattle firm.
Yeah, which is kind of boring.
I wanted to know about Bill Arnold.
Oh, yeah. W.C., quote, Fish, unquote, Arnold, was the vicar on earth for the canned salmon industry, which pretty much owned Alaska in its territorial days, although its power decreased gradually. Alaska was, for all practical purposes, during the territorial days, was run by a conglomerate or a triumvirate of the Interior Department, the canned salmon industry, and Alaska Steamship Company. Mm-hmm. And as we approached statehood, the grip of these of Alaska Steam and canned salmon was gradually loosened. Of course, Interior still has a grip on the state.
Was there a lawyer for Alaska Steamship Company, like there was, that's definitely associated with this?
I do not know. No name comes to mind. And Alaska Steam was in its waning days when I came here. Canned salmon was still very much a power, although it was also fading. Mm-hmm. But Arnold, who liked to be called Judge because he once was a U.S. commissioner in Ketchikan, was their man, and he was tied in tightly with the Seattle King County Bar. When Cremo McCutcheon and I fought the Seattle establishment in the Emard Will contest, he was the local lawyer for the Seattle interests in that case. And he was very influential before my time. He used to call the shots in the legislature and was very powerful. By the time I got to know him, his power was waning, but he had come up to Anchorage to set up quite a successful law practice with very fancy clients.
Who was Arnold associated with?
He was in with David Ruskin and another fellow whose name escapes me now because he didn't make much of an impression on me. You can probably check that out.
Mm-hmm. What kind of lawyer was Arnold? Was he a lawyer or was he a fixer or
he was a fixer primarily and a lobbyist, but he had some capabilities in the courtroom, except that he had become so suffused with the arrogance of power that he really didn't bother to do his homework. He just went in there and asserted things with a great air of confidence that may or may not have been legally correct. And I've only had three major trials with him, and he lost all three.
Mm-hmm. Who was he aligned with up here in the political community?
Republican.
Anybody in Anchorage?
I mean, any particular person?
Right. Any other attorneys that he would...
Possibly John Manders. I'm not sure of that. Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody else. He was more or less a loner when I knew him.
Personality-wise, did he mingle with the bar?
No. No, he was quite standoffish. And he had a great air of power around him, even after the real power had begun to dissipate. Mm-hmm. But he still acted like he was accustomed to it. When he'd snap his finger and the legislature would jump, you know, and he had that air about him.
Why did he have such power in the legislature?
Well, because Alaska Steam, just like the oil, canned salmon, like the oil industry now, could buy a lot of those legislators, campaign contributions and various bennies. Mm-hmm. And he was Fish Arnold. He was their man in Alaska.
Who were the legislators he had the most pull with?
I don't remember that. That was before my time.
You were going to tell me about Stevens and the case that you had with
Ted Stevens was the U.S. attorney in Fairbanks, and in 1954 or 55, I'm not sure. The government had a big drive to uproot or root out a bunch of business people in Fairbanks who had fallen into the habit during World War II to not pay any income taxes. And the government was too busy to bother with them. And Judge Forbes, who was the federal judge at that time, district judge, Vernon Forbes, had made it known publicly that any of them that were charged with income tax violations, but mostly failure, willful failure to file, were going to go to jail no matter what their position was, and one of the first cases to come up was a guy named Jack Marler, who was a CPA who had been a former deputy collector of Internal Revenue, and they wanted to make a special example out of him. And he hadn't filed his income tax returns for 3 years. And he was first represented by Bob Parrish, a very colorful and aggressive trial lawyer from Fairbanks, probably the best trial lawyer in Fairbanks at the time. And Bob had concocted the idea that Marler really hadn't willfully failed to file his income tax returns, but was trying to make a test as to whether, since Alaska was not a state and Congress had refused its statehood, whether it could be constitutionally taxed under the theory that it was taxation without representation. And everybody snickered at that, and much to everybody's shock and surprise, Parrish got a hung jury. So then the government really got panicky, and Ted Stevens took personal charge of the case, and he had a strike force sent up consisting of IRS people and experts in this field and that field and all kinds of support. And Parrish dropped the case at that point, and Marler came down here and in search of a new lawyer, and he was steered to me. He first saw John Hellenthal, and John Hellenthal told him it would be a fatal mistake to retain me because all I would do was antagonize the judge and jury. And Marla says, well, I saw that he was a graduate of Notre Dame and had a picture of the Pope in the front office, so I just wasn't too impressed. And I, against his advice, I came to you. So I took the case, and by this time it had national attention focused on it. And I tried the case, and Parrish had used the taxation without representation sort of as a window dressing, I made it the central theme. And I made a strictly a patriotic pitch to the jury and talked about the Peter Zenger trial, and that they were had a rendezvous with destiny, that Alaska was destined for statehood, and this would be a signal to the federal government that we didn't want taxation without representation. Well, and they acquitted him. And it was a... Stevens was horrified, and he had the paper there in his hand. Stevens has always been very good in getting the papers on his side. And he represented a lot of them. And they crucified us. And the verdict came in at midnight. The judge had said he would take it at any time. And Stevens had brought all the media people in. They were all gathered around the TV. And when the verdict was announced, I heard this big plop, and it was like Stevens' chin had fallen. And all the media people were swarming around Marler and I and taking pictures. And there were headlines from Honolulu to Washington, D.C. The Juno Empire had the biggest picture on its front page it ever had. The Fairbanks Newsminer had a red banner headline with pictures. The drinks were on the house in every bar that night. It was at And then the next day, the IRS people begged me to go on TV and radio and explain to the Alaskans it did not mean they didn't have to pay their income tax. And I was on the Today Show came and interviewed me, and CBS Newsreel in my office, and Newsweek had an article entitled "Rebellion in Alaska." It was quite sensational.
What year was it?
I think it was 56. I'm not sure. 55 or 56.
Can you contrast the Juneau Bar and the Anchorage Bar and the Fairbanks Bar?
Yeah. Of course, they're dynamic. The Anchorage Bar particularly is dynamic, and it has evolved. In the old days, the Juneau Bar were the elite, you know. They were the fancy lawyers with the fancy clients, outfits like Faulkner, Boutchever, Banfield, and so forth. They were the power. Anchorage was kind of lusty and brawling, and they had a few leading firms, and the rest were a bunch of lawyers grubbing around. And Fairbanks was and is kind of marginal, I mean, in terms of ability and in terms, and certainly still informal, you know, very informal. Anchorage has become much more formal, and Juneau has always been formal. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of marginal lawyers in Fairbanks that couldn't make it anyplace else. And then there are a few outstanding ones that just somehow landed there and like it there for some strange reason.
Who are the outstanding ones?
Charlie Cole is one. Bill Boggess is one. This is very subjective, you understand, my evaluation. Let's see. I know there are some more that will come to mind. Bob Parrish, of course, when he was there. He's now retired. His sons are carrying on the tradition. I'd have to take a look at the bar to really answer that, but there are a few good ones.
Are there good ones in Juneau?
Oh, the Juneau Bar has always been very, very professionally very excellent.
Mm-hmm.
They're just kind of stodgy and boring.
Yeah.
But they're good lawyers. Bob Boutchever is a perfectly good example. He's an excellent lawyer, but, you know, a bit of a stuffed shirt.